Anyway, let me continue, because the truth is that these shurim have many students that don't appear face-to-face, but everyone pops up in America and tells me they're hearing the shurim, and I see they are, because they start talking with me, and they think I remember what... there are three copies going out that I know of, that go out from me. So out of those three copies, they make hundreds of copies, you understand? Now that Nordlich will have it, so there's England of a self. Just be aware, but the shurim are not recorded for public distribution. It's recorded in the classroom, which gives me the right to talk to my students honestly, and no one can sue me for defamation of character if I call someone a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, ruthless, depraved, degenerate, the brownstone, the tishlam, level, no good, bummy, apikoros. That's what a Rebbe has a right to do in class, and you can't sue him outside of class. Okay, at the end of the class, if I rise, I will tell you the compliment I got this year, which is second to none, even though it's arrogant for me to repeat it, but nevertheless, you should have the feeling that a little Bronx boy can achieve something in life. Now, you see, what we dealt with last time, and again, I always worry that you don't really fully identify with the Rebbe and where he lived, because you're living the year 203. It's a different world today. The problems I spoke about yesterday, you know, when you think about yesterday's shiur and when you'll hear next week's shiur on the continuation, it didn't exist in the 50s. We couldn't have dreamt. I could not dream that a Rebbe would get a shaila from a very serious, sincere girl at the age of 35, whether she's allowed to go to mikveh to sleep with a boy on the west side, because the boy won't go out with her a third time without knowing if she'll go to mikveh. It didn't exist. It couldn't be, you understand? Single girls that turn being single into an art, you understand? We'll see that. You'll see next week what I'm referring to. These trembling before God. It couldn't be. It couldn't be. We always knew, look, that homosexuality was always a problem in the yeshiva world. I can tell you that when Hemreich put out the volume, The Yeshiva World, so Rabbi, I was, by that time, when Willie Hemreich, and I'm talking about his volume, was a very important volume, the World of the Yeshiva. He thanks me, if you read the introduction, because I already had published Revel and Silva, and he thought it was a big shot. You know, by now, Hemreich is a big, big shot. But he's a YU boy from the West Side. I think he's second generation Holocaust parents survivors. He was maybe a year or two younger than me. I remember him yet. I remember him yet from yeshiva. So he may be a year or two younger than me. I remember him from yeshiva. And he put out that volume. And by that time, I was very close to Moshe Scherer, which is a story unto itself, but it's not for now. Be'ezrat Hashem, in what I'm working on now, I'll tell the whole story, because it's a fascinating story with a lot of implications for Klal Yisrael that continue until today. So Moshe Scherer said to me that he's very in debt to Willy Helmreich. And I asked Moshe Scherer why, because, I mean, after all, here's Willy Helmreich, is not exactly Aaron Lichtenstein, is not exactly, you know, if you take a good YU boys, Heschel Shechta, even Aaron Rakefet, so you can understand that a great agudist like Moshe Scherer can have a safa meshutefet. You understand, we have a lot in common, our commitment to Torah, even though our hashkafas are not the same. But Willy Helmreich is not exactly, he's a frum Jew, but he's not a Gon, he's not a... And I said to him, why are you so in debt to him? And he told me, Moshe Scherer said to me, look, when he did his research on the yeshiva world, and he spent many hours with me, he uncovered the problem of homosexuality, which always existed, and he didn't write about it. He didn't write about it. Now, Willie's a scholar. He could have justified it, said, look, I'm a scholar. You know, like all scholars say, they have to write about everything. Could have written about it. So we did have a problem, and there was a problem. There always was this interaction. See, it came up after class last week, and I don't have a black and white answer. I struggle with the problem. I've spoken about it many times in public with the Hirshine approach. It's not for now. But you see, the problem is, so what do I say? What do we say? It's no good, in other words, if you don't go out with a girl 20 times, Rit Moshe Bik. So how can you get married? You wind up divorced. If you get married too young, you wind up divorced. If you don't talk with a girl, a boy doesn't talk to a girl, a girl doesn't talk to a boy, they don't know how to talk by the time, you know, but you're in your 30s, it's too late already to get married. How do you find the happy balance? So, you see, is it better the boys and girls should talk to each other? But then you can wind up, boys and girls holding hands, nigi, every day. I'm going to talk about it in Midrashit Moriah. Or worse, Bisman Hazeh, or worse. all right, you're taking a risk. Maybe that risk is better than taking the risk and wind up with all these people not married, Ribbono Shel Olam, and the whole West Side scene. And by the way, in the right-wing world, you have it too, to a certain degree in America, because what's called right-wing in America, in Israel, they wouldn't let them in the door. You understand what they call a black hat in America bears very little resemblance to a Haredi, Alat Mata Kodesh. There's a world of... A black hat in America is a why you guy slightly diminished or slightly improved. Call it what you wish. In Israel, it's two different worlds. And you see, this is a problem in the yeshiva world. You keep the boys and girls separate. You tell the boys not to look at the girls. My time. So you run the risk of certain homosexualities. It's better to have that, or you have them intermingling. It's no good the other way. It's dinei nefashot. Obviously, I would rather have a boy and a girl intermingle than have homosexuality. But the problem exists. And that whole world is different than what we have today. The Rav totally functioned in a different world. I got caught up with this in America. You fellas aren't aware of it, but Rabbi Simcha Krause evidently published an article based upon a talk he gave here in Israel. It was published in Jewish Week. It was a very anti-black world article. Okay, published by Rabbi Simcha Krause. In the article, he quotes from my book, he quotes the Rav. Now, he didn't cite me by name, that Rakefet quoted this, but all the Mevinim knew that it was from my book, because they knew where did Krauss get it from. So a fellow like, let's say, someone I respect greatly, like Rabbi Bert Leff, he went and checked out from my book back to the tape, because he couldn't believe the Rav said it, and Krauss was quoting it, they hit the right wing over the head. And he checked it out. The Rav Taka said it. He says, Aaron, same to me, you recorded it, you wrote it up word by word. And the key factor here is, you have to understand, the Rav was functioning 50 years ago, 40 years ago. It was a different world. Our world was different. The YU world was different. The right-wing world was different. Tells was different. Everything was different. So you have to understand that in context. And that's why last week when I spoke about the relationship with Rabbi Shubau, I think I hit the nail on the head, because what's fascinating about Rabbi Shubau is that he is a genrei, it's a type of student that a whole Jewish Institute of Religion, the example I gave with Rabbi Kirschbaum, I just passed by on Main Street, I was walking with my wife, and I showed her the Rabbi Usher Kirschbaum school, and I said, see, I was talking with the fellows about him, but they really can't identify with this type of conservative rabbi. It doesn't exist today. These were Orthodox in practice, trained in a so-called Reform seminary, and took conservative shuls. They didn't have the zitz flesh, or they were too old. Just take one like Rabbi Shubau. He was in World War II. He was a chaplain. He was this, he was that. They didn't have the zitz flesh to get a proper smicha. So they became rabbis for Klal Yisrael, but they never lost their basic commitment to Torah. And they melted in the presence of the Rav. See, and this is why the Rav could be very friendly with Shubau. But if you take someone like Rabbi Epstein, who lived down the block and was a Talmud Chacham, but he was a conservative rabbi. Understand, there was a big difference. And the Rav could never be intimate with him, because there it was a world in conflict. And this is the way I understand the Rav, and that's that relationship with Shubau, and that's the story. To me, it was a beautiful story. It captures, it's a picture. Sometimes a certain anecdote is like a picture. It captures an era. But that's a perfect picture where the Rev refuses to do a double ring ceremony, but the Chatan didn't succeed in breaking the glass, and the Rev walks away, and Rabbi Shubau says, Rabbi, he says, Rabbi, I don't understand you. A double ring ceremony you won't do. Now, you know, to a simplistic mind who's not well founded in the halacha, what's wrong with a double ring ceremony? Now you do a double ring. You understand? I lost when I was a kid, when I was your age. I was in the rabbinate already. I was a kid. I was 24, 25. I lost $50 because of a double ring. You know what $50 meant to 1964, $50? Like someone telling you today to give you $500 for Sadeh Kedushin. I can still tell you the name of the couple. And a dean's grandchildren, and they said them, but Rabbi, we have to have a double ring ceremony where we are conservative. You know, they were conservative. I said, I can't perform with them. I lost $50. They went to a conservative rabbi. And, you know, what's wrong? I can be malamed zchut. I give the girl the ring, I'm kind of her with the ring. The other, she gives the guy a ring. It's a chuk of klulis, a main garnish. Look, I can assure you, plenty of guys with long beards would have swallowed the $50 under their beards, and they would have justified it very simple. Ah, what's so terrible? What's so terrible? You understand? It's a chukle tlud, it's a narishkeit. This counts, the other thing doesn't count. You understand? But if you have a feeling, it uproots all of Yiddishkeit. See, a double ring ceremony is like Yiddishkeit is you take it and you're playing games with it. You understand? It's not halakhically he's kind of with the first ring, the second ring doesn't count, absolutely. But there's something much deeper here at stake. And with breaking the glass, what that's become, you have to understand the average mind of the person breaking the glass. You understand? I've seen it. They have all types of superstitions. If the woman kicks the man while he's breaking the glass, she's going to be the boss over him. Today, the feminists want to break a glass for her, a glass for him. You understand? It's ludicrous. Ribbono shel Olam, it's ludicrous. Let them break the glass together. Let them step on each other's foot. Let the glass roll away. The Hagitzich, I aims the under and leave me out of it. That's what the rabbi should say. But you see, to the simplistic mind, breaking the glass, wow, this is the hype. And this is what he says. He says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't understand you. A double ring ceremony you won't do. But breaking the glass, he didn't break it. Terrible. And the rabbi gives him a wave, you know, and walks on. It's garnished. Forget it. He's whatever he called Shubauer. Shubala. Forget it. Don't worry about it. And this captures America, the London and the well-meaning rabbi who doesn't know much. And to me, it captures America. But my explanation of their relationship is, I think, is right on. And all the pullum in the world that the Rav was liberal or the Rav's outlook and all the articles, it's amazing the way scholarship is written. You know, now I start to see all the mistakes that are made. People publish, and each one is ego, each one salutes the other, and they criticize anyone who says it. It's well, that's scholarship. But it's not honest. There has to be honesty. To build a thesis out of this with the rabbi, you have to know who, what, when, where, and within the time capsule when it happened. But I stand on what I said, and in Hachinami, the rabbi had a wonderful relationship with Rabbi Joseph Shubow, but he did not have an intimate relationship with other conservative rabbis, and my explanation of last time, I believe, is correct. Whether I did the right thing to quote the Boston Rebbe, it's a machlokes tova and a tara. Tova thought I was ingenious because I said, look, I know I'm going to get attacked here saying your father respected or had a relationship with a conservative rabbi, but if I quote the Boston Rebbe that he also loved Rabbi Shubow, and so Tosafot says it's ingenious because you can attack the Rav, you can attack Rakefet, but an Agudist has to hold off. The Boston and the Rebbe is a member of the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. Jonathan Sapir, here's the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. He's shivering. Jonathan, I bite my lips when I hear the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. Nish the Moetzet, Nish Gedolei, Nish Kainteira. Garnished. I've lived here too long to be impressed by fancy words. Elal's flying on Shabbos. Have you heard one word from the Moetzet since I spoke to you 3 weeks ago? Remember, I walked into Shia devastated. Have you heard one word? Not from the Gedolim, not the Torah, not Aguda, not the Galatayrin, not Akrit Yisrael, not Shas. A bunch of phonies. Give them a little money and they'll sell their mothers on Shabbos and on Yom Kippur. They'll eat her with a ham sandwich mixed with milk. Find me from Jews in the world, okay? In this room, you'll find a few. Baruch Hashem. Don't get too impressed. But you were raised, and then people have an attitude today. They think, oh, wow. Good. You better do tshuva, and you better do it completely and thoroughly. That's what you have to do. Don't tell me, Aguda. You have a lot to al-chait for. Now, so don't get impressed. Okay. But Torah felt she was furious. She said to me, my father does not need the Boston Rebbe. You understand? The Boston Rebbe compared to the Rebbe, you're comparing, Jonathan, with all due respect to you and Ricky, together, where do you come to Rav Heschel Shechter? You understand what I'm saying? His knowledge, It's mine by Baron Lichtenstein. You understand? The Boston Rebbe to the Rav, I don't want to go further. You understand? So, Atar is right, what can I do? But I have to live with the real world. I don't want my Rebbe to be attacked. So I put in the Boston Rebbe. If you get mad at the Rav, get mad at the Boston Rebbe. So I'm a Zayin Gesund. Okay, now, the Rav always loved Rabbi Shubau, and he comes back to him again. And this is a story. You see, the Rav in public, when you give a public lecture, obviously, it's very different when I have to lecture in public or lecture to my class. You're much more relaxed when you know who you're talking to. And you know, you can, in other words, you can interact because you know exactly Dalaf Nei Miyata Omeid. When the Rav spoke at a Sheva Brachas, he had people he was very close with, the Holzer of family, very close to. As intimate as the Rav could be, as letting his hair down, the Holzer family, the Klavan family, understand? We're talking the president of the OU today, he's the son-in-law of Izzy Klavan, Blitz. I think he's a lawyer. The person who's president of the OU is the son-in-law of Izzy Klavan, who was the Rav's counter ego. The Rav had a classmate of mine, very interesting fellow. You'll notice here, I'm 1310, Dr. Alan Goldstein. Dr. Alan Goldstein was a Tells boy, and Tells in my time was big, had good Rosh Yeshiva, and he wanted to become a doctor, so he left Tells, he came to YU. And for us, a Tells boy, a number of fellows from Tells had come into YU during my era, but he knew how to learn, he fit right in with the crowd. And he studied, when I learned with the Rav, he studied me, and then he went on to become a doctor. He became the Rav's, basically his personal physician. He had a devoted Talmud of the Rav, and obviously a devoted physician. In my work on the Rav, you'll see pictures of him at the Yachei Kala. And the Rav felt very at home with Alan Goldstein. And what I'm quoting to you is that a Sheva Brachot that the Goldsteins made for the Klavan children when they got married, 1974. And there the Rav let his hair down, and we come back to our friend Shubau with a story that has no lasting significance, but it does have practical myths and touches upon a part of the rabbinate that is very real. And that is Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, a rabbi has to make a siyum. All right. Rabbi has to make a siyum. We're going to come back to this later today. Rabbis are the busiest people in the world. This is the plus of the rabbinate. It's also the great minus of the rabbinate. And we're going to deal with it very seriously later today. Rabbis are busy. Got to make a siyum. What are you going to do for a siyum? I have seen rabbis, and I hate to say this, Orthodox rabbis, that will take a Gemara, study the last daf, and make a phony siyum. Okay? Rabbi Yosef Weiss, who I spoke about last night, once gave me advice 50 years ago, 40 years ago, a little more than 40. He said, if you ever have to make a quick siyum, Masechet Tamid. And I, God bless him for it, because Masechet Tamid is more than Mishnayot. It has a little bit Gemara, and it's Kadesh Yaseh. You don't have to be a Reb Chaim Zimmerman to finish Masechet Tamid in a few hours. Do you know what I'm talking about, Reb Chaim Zimmerman? You know the story with Reb Chaim Zimmerman? Did I ever tell you the story with the corned beef sandwich? Yes or no? Ah, this story, I told it over the years, but this story, if you don't know the story, you don't understand Gedolei Torah, you don't understand Reb Chaim Zimmerman, Zeichet Tzadik L'Achu, Reb Chaim Zimmerman, he never found his place in life. Reb Chaim Zim was Reb Berach Be'er's labor with his nephew. And he was too open-minded for Europe, right? He was one of these minds that knew all of science and all of mathematics and all of Shaz, everything. So Reb Berach Be'er threw him out and told him to go to America. He comes to America, came into Rabbi Revel's home, came into the yeshiva, and of course he was a genius of geniuses, and winds up in Borough Park, then he goes to Chicago, becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, then he comes to Aliyah. While he was in Chicago, he had a Talmud, they're not alive anymore, you'll recognize the name Norman Frimmer. Mean anything to you? The father of Aye Frimmer, Dov and Aye Talmidim of the Rav, of Rabbi Lichtenstein. But Normie was a Chicago boy. He was the head of the Hillel houses in America, B'nai B'rith. He worked for B'nai B'rith. A fabulous individual. He was very... Reb Chaim Zimmerman was his Rebbe. So one time they're walking in Chicago, West Rogers Park, and Chaim says to Normie, Normie, I gotta have a corned beef sandwich tonight. I gotta have a corned beef sandwich. And Norman says, Rebbe, it's the 9 days. Chaim says, Norman, Don't worry about the 9 days. Meet me at the deli at 8 o'clock tonight. We're having supper together, 8 p.m. at the deli. Okay, this was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Come to the deli, and Norman is shivering. He's a frum kid. You know, Ezra, this is the 9 days. You know, you can't play games, even if Rabbi Starr was a Rosh Yeshiva in Chicago. You know that, right? There was a famous Rosh Yeshiva there, Rabbi Starr. Any relation? No, you told me already no once. Maybe by now the relation grew on you. And Chaim Zimmern walks in. He opens up Baba Batra, makes a siyum, and they go make a party, and they have deli and whatnot. So Normie says, Rebbe, when did you start Baba Batra? He says, oh, I started at 3 o'clock this afternoon. So that's Reb Chaim Zimmerman. But Masechet Tamid, you don't have to be Reb Chaim Zimmerman to handle it in a few hours. So here the Rav tells the story about Rabbi Shubau, that he once gets a call on Erev Pesach, and he says, I'm quoting the Rav, he says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, help me. Disaster has struck. And the Rav says, what are you so worried about? What's happened? And Shubau tells him that he was learning Masechet Makot. And I'm quoting the Rav, I enjoyed it very much. I kept my Gemara open on my desk. My wife was cleaning for Pesach, and she put away my Gemara, and I can't find the Masechet Makot. And this poor guy, and you know, where's Masechet Makot printed? And he tells him, the Rav says to him, well, look, maybe it's printed with Sanhedrin. Take Sanhedrin, try Avodah Zarah. And no matter what he tries, Shubau can't find it. And then the Rav recalls, as he's talking with Shubau, that he once saw in his mother's house a unique printing of the Gemara where Masechet Makot was published with Baba Kama. And he tells Shubau, maybe try Baba Kama. He goes to Baba Kama, he opens it, and there in back is Masechet Makot. Suddenly the Rav hears his voice on the telephone. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you are a genius, you are a scholar, you have prophecy. Now why I see why people consider you a great scholar. How could you know where it was in my edition of the Shas? And after the Rav finishes the story, he says, and these are the type of siyumin you have today in Erev Pesach. You can imagine already what a London Rabbi Shubau was and how much he knew of Makot and how much he learned. But the Rav was giving them hell that today a siyum is not a siyum. They don't probably learn. And this was a little anecdote the Rav told. Now, I have to tell you, number one, it shows the Rav's relationship with Shubau. Number two, it shows you the relationship of Shubau to the Rav, that if the Rav could tell him where to find Masechet Makot, you're a genius, you're a scholar, Ad Kedei Kach, Shubau gets carried away, you have prophecy. But I have to tell you, I worked very hard to find what the Rav was talking about. Where do you find the Shas that should have Makot at the end of Baba Kama? See, my scholarly instinct, is this story true? And then something else bothered me. How did Shubau get hold of such a shas? Assuming there is such a shas, of all the shas in Tehran. And I put it all together. You got to have protection. At the Hebrew University Library, there's a woman who works there, Mrs. Steiner, Rachel Steiner. She is a great niece of Professor Avraham Freiman, the great Professor Freiman. She's a Freiman via her mother. You follow me? Her grandmother is a Freiman. And the great Professor Freiman, who I quote, and says, oh, I owe so much to that, to Professor Freiman. He was killed in a convoy going up to Mount Scopus, 1948. God have mercy, what we're going through, what we've gone through, what we went through yesterday, what we went through this morning. Ein l'davasof, ein l'davasof, ein l'davasof. And so she checked it out for me and helped me and guided me. And I found that there was a shas printed. Look at my footnote in 1897 in Vilna, where they taka did a different order and put Makot together with Baba Kama. How did Rabbi Shubau get hold of the shas? So if you noticed my footnote, remember I told you last week that this Rabbi Shubau was a very interesting individual. He had been the Jewish chaplain in Patton's army. I mean, this is not easy. The Third Army, very interesting individual. He ran around. After he left the army, General Patton did a gesture and gave him the jeep that he used in the army. He gave him permission to keep the jeep. And people told me from Boston that Schubert was a character. Every other rabbi was driving around in a Dodge, a face in a Chevrolet, whatever people drove in the 40s into the 50s, and there was Schubert driving to funerals, to weddings, in his army jeep. You got to admit, this guy is one of a kind. Then I put it all together. My head went to work. Now, there's something you don't know, but something I know, because I lived it. I lived it. I researched it. I lived it. I saw it. Following World War II, there were tremendous DP camps. Some of you are grandchildren of displaced persons, so you know what I'm talking about. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were here, were there, were everywhere. One of the things they did in the DP camps under the supervision of the United States Army, they reprinted the entire Shas on German soil. It was done. You understand, the Americans have a concept of taking revenge. If you see what they're doing to Al-Qaeda today, you understand with that. And imagine in America too, they're worried, the Europeans, you're not treating the prisoners properly, we have to investigate, have to send the Red Cross, you know, to knock down the Twin Towers and to kill thousands of Americans, that's okay. But to capture some Al-Qaeda and you're worried about their civil rights, and then suddenly in America they're dealing with a ticking bomb. I saw a debate on the Israeli television from the American television with Dershowitz, who spoke well, and some other. The other guy, a moron, he can't torture a guy. No, it's better. 1,000 people should be blown up, but you can't torture an individual to get the information out of him. Right? It's a pleasure to see America debating and not criticizing Israel. So, they went and they reprinted the Shas under the supervision. Have you ever seen the Shas where it's mamish published under the supervision of the American army, of the Bar Hatzalah? It's mind-boggling. And that Shas follows the order of Vilna. Look at my footnote. Look what Rakefet put together here. And now it all fits together. How did Shubo get it? He was a chaplain. Even if he had left the military by the time the Shas was printed, he had protexia. A Shas like this, you don't give Rabbi Joseph Shubo, General Patton's Jewish chaplain, the Third Army? Now it all fits together. So he had the reprint of the 1897 Vilna. And the Rav Taka saw the Shas in his mother's house. But that ain't the Shas that Rabbi Shubo had. Rabbi Shubo had the Shas of the American army, which was a photo offset of that Shas. And Ein Hachinami, the Rav, had mazel that he hit upon. Take a look. Maybe your wife put it away, but it's Baba Kama, you understand? Because on the outside, it just said the main Masechet. It didn't say the subsidiary Masechet. I've seen Shasim like that. He grabbed the Baba Kama. The Rav became a genius. But what a comment on the Siyum we make. So bear in mind, gentlemen, you got to make a Siyum if you're hard-pressed. Masechet Tamid, it's always waiting. Give credit to your Rebbe, who gives credit to Rabbi Yosef Weiss, who saved my life for many a year in the act of wrapping it. Chas v'chalila, don't become a phony and open up that last page and read the last line and make a siyum. And I know one Orthodox rabbi, he said, I had no choice, I couldn't do it any other way, I didn't want to disappoint the Balabatim, but Hurachum Yechav Pre'avon, and that's the way he made a siyum on Erev Pesach. Okay. Now we come to one of the most famous moments in the Rav's life. We've spoken about this many times over the decades. I cannot tell you how crucial this moment is. People who have selective memories, if you look at the Adar and that entire world that I speak about, the concept of surrender, somehow they conveniently overlook this moment. I want to be very brief because I've given an entire shurim on this, of course, not this year, but in past years. But you all know the story. The story is very simple. By the 1970s, the Aguna problem became real on the American scene. Why human beings can be so cruel is beyond me. But human beings, I guess when they fight, Koso, Kiso, Kaso, we become very cruel. And there's nothing crueler than using the halacha to torture another human being. So a marriage doesn't work. And I have to tell you, look, marriage is not working. There isn't a society yet that was able to figure out a way to solve these problems equitably, fairly, and quickly. Marriage is very involved. You get married, you have joint property. How do you divide joint property? Who brings in? The man works, but the woman supports him. She takes care of the house. She has a right to the joint property. The woman works. Labriyut bisman hazeh. The man brought in an inheritance. The woman brought in an inheritance. I know a case where a woman threw a man out. I was involved in getting the man to give a get for him. He didn't want to give a get. I convinced him to give a get. It's an interesting story, but it's not for now. The only thing the woman would give him back is his father's collection of rare coins. And he wouldn't take it. It's still in the hands of the rabbi, because he's furious at the rabbi who made a promise in front of me that if he gives a get, he'll see to it that he can see his children. His woman, the woman ran away to Vancouver, Nova Scotia. Dafka's a Kollel rabbi. It's a Talmud of mine from the Kollel. I faxed him. He faxed me. I met him. We spoke. He can't do a darn thing. He said to me, Rebbe, I can't do anything. It's very complex. He's a young rabbi. I would take the woman and get the mafia after her. You know, no, she has to be told. You have a get. He's a father. You hate his guts, you hate his guts. But it's his children. He has a right to see the children, you understand? All right. She won't take the... But it's very... It's a difficult question. Halacha, kama v'kama, when you take the halacha and their children involved, how do you divide up children? Who has custody of children? The halacha has one approach, the batei dinim have one approach. You should know, the batei dinim in Israel are infinitely better than the American courts. Because the American courts today will give children to fathers. But they did them in Israel, inevitably, if the children are young, the mothers get the children. I can only tell you from my experience, doesn't matter who's right or wrong, a child raised by a father without a mother has infinitely more problems than a child raised by a mother without a father. A mother, what we spoke about yesterday, Chava v'hiyem kol chai. Yes, wait, Daniel, yeah. I know that. I'm well aware. I'm aware.
Until the early 1920s,
right. You're talking about in America.
I'm talking about in Europe.
Okay. Dr. Jackson says, but that may be best served by the father. What's that? No. Fine. Everything you're saying is correct, and that may be because of financial reasons. Okay. But. One second. But then the courts rule generally the mother. Now they changed, and my daughter tells me in Israel, it works out much better because the courts generally, unless they're extenuating circumstances, the batei dinim will always give the mother. Because see, a mother's a mother. But these are tremendous problems. What do you do with children? How do you divide them up? How do you take a child from a divorced home 1 week here, 1 week there? I had one girl last year, one night with a father, they had joint custody. So the girl said, one night she was with her father. One night. I said, doesn't it get confusing? She said, well, you learn to live with it. Yes, Moshe.
There are times, not more than
I understand. Fine. That's what I mean by extenuating circumstances. But a gut feeling is, although the halacha, by the way, may be different. I'm not saying halacha, but halacha says the boys to the father. But anyway, the courts here generally send the boys and the girls to the mother. I accept everything you're saying. It's not a problem. But I'm just trying to show you that money, children, a divorce, it's difficult. No one has the exact answers. But see, halachically, we have a terrible problem. Because on that level, the man can walk away, the man can remarry. At the worst, he's a bigamist. He's over Chayim the Rabbeinu Geshem. I don't have to tell you, in Bnei Brak, they don't take a Chayim very seriously. Because as Shai Akhtun said, as Shmuel Yosef Akhtun said, in Jerusalem, 1 week you're in Chayim, 1 week you beat the other guy in Chayim. In other words, who muhram, who machrim. You understand? If you walk past the bulletin boards in Main Shurim, I've yet to see a happy notice up. I'm living here 33 years. All I see in the bulletin boards, this one died and that one died and this Chayrim and destroying Klal Yisrael and Mechalul Shabbos and this and that and the other thing. You don't see one happy note up. And the amazing thing is, who's in Chayrim? The guy they're putting in Chayrim last week put the other guy in Chayrim. So a Chayrim doesn't mean much to us because we're not a close society. But the woman, Chas v'Chalila, if she remarries, it's adultery. And he refuses to give a get. And this problem already, holding up a woman for a get, you see, this is our obsession with money, All right, maybe human beings were always like this, but Adam Nido Bekiso Bakaso, it's frightening. I once taught a student of mine a lesson. He was having a machloket with people over 500 shekel. It was years ago, 500 shekel was 500 shekel, and I was impoverished at the time. I wrote out a check for 500. I said, "You're an idiot." I gave him a check for 500 shekel, a personal check. All right, he ripped up the check. He never cashed it. He said, Rebbe, you taught me a lesson. I said, over 500 shekel. People, money, killing. Okay. Now, I want to be Malamed Tzchak. Rabbi Rachman is not a right winger for sure. If you read One Man's Judaism, which I read from cover to cover, there's no doubt on my mind. I once described One Man's Judaism, and you should read it from cover to cover. I say he has 1 foot in the conservative camp and one foot orthodox, and he dances back and forth. On a personal level, Rabbi Emanuel Rachman is one of the nicest, finest people you will ever want to meet. I mean, of course, he's an old man today. I knew him in his prime. I learned Bechavruta with his son Michael 50 years ago. I was at Ben Bayit in his home in Far Rockaway. He was a prince of an individual. But he was a great mekil. He permitted, for instance, using the telephone on Yontif, using electric lights on Yontif. There are many kula down the line which already were not acceptable by most Orthodox Jews at that time. Then this terrible problem developed of the aguna, self-inflicted aguna, being held up for money. And he suggested, it was at an RCA convention in 1975, it was late at night, and the RCA always runs behind time. Bert Left reminded me that he, when the Israeli government sent me to address the 1977 convention, which was the first time I returned to America, I came in Israel impoverished. I was a poor little kid. I came an idealist. I never dreamt I would see America again. Fortunately or unfortunately, I wound up with the Mossad and Russia and having to go here and there and wind up in America and back and forth. I wind up today, if I would accept all the invitations I have, I would make a living, as I told you, but I would have to stop teaching, so I would drop dead from lack of students. So you got to make a choice whether making money is more important or being alive and teaching Torah, Davar Hashem, Zu Halacha, and Hashkafa, and Avat Hashem. Make your choice. So, but Rabbi Left reminded me in 1977 at the RCA convention, he said, "Aaron, I had supper in his house last Sunday night. He made a supper with a whole group of rabbis. Aaron, what you did to me and said, you don't remember." I said, "What do you mean?" I remembered what I did. I know he was the guy. He was chairman. And he slipped me a note that we're running behind schedule as usual. And I said in public to the chairman, I didn't know it was Rabbi, I forgot it was Bert Left. I said, "Rabbi, I've come all the way from Israel to deliver this paper, and you are telling me you are running behind schedule?" And I threw the note back, and I continued with my paper, and the audience applauded. They wanted to hear more. They didn't care they were running behind schedule. So Rabbi Rachman spoke 75. You got to know, you've been to, maybe some of you have seen these RCA conventions. You're always behind schedule. It was at night. He spoke quickly. But in that talk, and Rabbi Lamb spoke, it was Lamb, and Rachman was the same forum. I believe Rabbi Gedalia Schwartz, I have a tape of it. I have a tape from 75. I was living in Israel, but I heard the whole talk. It was on, can we help women? Can we revise marital problems? Rabbi Gedalia Schwartz, who today, George Schwartz, is Av Beit Din of RCA, a Talmud Chacham, he spoke. In addition, then Naomi Lamb spoke. He was not yet president of YU. He was rabbi of Jewish Center. And then the eminent Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who was rabbi after all of, he was the man who built Far Rockaway. You don't know that. Shari Tfila was the most elegant shul. And then he's rabbi Fifth Avenue Synagogue. I mean, these are not small positions. Then he goes on to become Chancellor Bar Ilan. And he spoke. And in his talk, he takes Hafkat Kedushin very simplistically, because you got to remember, I know a fellow named Aaron Rakefet. He lectured on Hafkat Kedushin 1 full year in the Kol. If you don't believe Aaron Rakefet, you got Jack sitting here. We'll testify. 1 full year. So you can't, Hafkat Kedushin, it's not exactly a topic you can deal with in 5 minutes. But very simplistically, Rabbi Rachman said that if a man refuses to give a get, and the rabbis are convinced, and you got to remember, you got to know that she's not at fault. That's the whole problem here in human relations. Not always is the man at fault. Occasionally the woman may be at fault. Generally speaking, it's the man, because he can hold over the woman to get no gitti, no tiki, no washi, like the Chinaman used to say, no tiki, no gitti. If you don't pay up the ticket of money, you don't get the get. Generally, it's the man's fault. And he threw out this Hafkat Kedushin. Okay? In addition, he touched upon the fact, and we mentioned this yesterday, we'll come into it next week, that sands are shifting, and women today make their own living. Women today are well off. Women today are educated. Women today have panasa. And if this is the case, tav lemeitav tandu me lemeitav amala does not apply. Now all of you are tamei chachamim, and you all understand what does it mean. You've learned the Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Kufur, I believe. But anyway, there's sugyas all over Shas, where a lot of halakha is premised on a chazaka, on an assumption. And the assumption is that a woman will say, better any man than no man. Okay? That's an interesting question. Better any man than no man. And Rabbi Rachman says, Bizman Hazeh, this chazaka should not apply. And if that's the case that it doesn't apply, it would have halakhic implications. It would be easier to dissolve marriages. You can say mechtot, you understand? Rabbi Moshe himself already says mekachtot, but Rabbi Moshe says mekachtot. For instance, there are two cases from the Tribute of Rabbi Moshe that you come up with mekachtot. One case is late koach gavra, impotence. Ein lecha mekachtot yotega dol mizeh. And if a man who's impotent, and the woman can prove it, she's still a virgin, she goes to a doctor. I just had a case like that, halacha lemaisa, from a fellow in the Kolil. Obviously it's not him, but the girl that he wants to marry. It's a very involved case, because he's a Kohen, and she had been married before, but she's a virgin. They're both my students. It's a tragic case. He's a Kohen, and she's a Grusha, but she's a Grusha who's a virgin. It's a very interesting case, and she went to a great specialist in Jerusalem, a female doctor and a gynecologist, a great doctor, who's a very firm woman, a tzaddikit, a French woman. I know her very well. My family knows her very well. And she gave a tzettel, a petik, that she has examined this woman and she is a virgin. So, late koach gavra, the guy doesn't want to give a get. There was never kedushin. She was never married. The other case where Rav Moshe deals with it is someone who has mental problems, and he had mental problems before the wedding. She didn't know about it. He already had been confined to an institution before they got married. She had proof of this, and had she known, she would have never married him. So if he refuses to give a get, you follow me, Yoni? You have room here to move. Okay. So Rabbi Rachman says, Bizman Hazeh, where the Chazakah no longer exists, in his opinion, that you would have many more cases where you could say, Mekach Ta'ut, and you would solve many problems of men who don't want to give gittin. And this is what Rabbi Rachman said very quickly. Now, the Rub was not in the audience, but they told Rebbe what Rabbi Rachman said. 2 weeks later, YU Rabbinic Alumni had a conference at YU at First Hall. And it was open to the YU Rabbinic Alumni. That conference was going to deal with Geirut. The main topic of that conference was a topic that we're going to spend a lot of time on in a halacha sheyorim, dealing with Geirut. And Rebbe got up, and first of all he said, you know, I didn't expect such a big crowd. He thought it would only be rabbis. But when everyone heard the Rav is speaking, this is 1975, when the Rav is the Rav in the full sense of the word, and also the Rav is aged already, so people, you know, you realize now you got to take advantage of every second. So everyone who understood a little English piled into the room. There were hundreds and hundreds of Talmidim of the yeshiva piled in to hear Rebbe. And Rebbe felt a little awkward because what he wanted to say to Rabbanim. But nevertheless, he went and Shelo Kedako B'Kodesh. Because you have to understand, the Rav, and I spoke about this 2 years ago, and it's absolutely true, the Rav had been very mellowed at an early age by Machloket. The Rav himself would have been like Chaim. He's a very strong individual with very set ideas. He had the competence of his knowledge, the competence of his learning, the competence of his family heritage, and the Rav would have been very strident. But he entered the rabbinate, and he had all the difficulties and the kashrut problems, everything we spoke about 2 years ago, and the Rav from that point on shied away from Machloket. And if you don't believe what I'm saying, open up Panini HaRab by Rav Heschel Shechter. Take a look at the letter Rav Heschel says to one of his Talmidim, the Rav wrote. Don't get involved in Machloket, even L'Shem Shemayim. What Rav Heschel neglected to write was that the Talmud the Rav wrote it to was a guy named Arnold Rothkopf. And Einachinami, the Rav not only wrote that to me, but I also spoke with him many times. And the Rav's attitude was, constantly tried to avoid machloket. Nothing good comes out of machloket. And the Rav didn't attack. The Rav was not strident. The Rav was extremely open-minded. The Rav, as you know, as a Rebbe, allowed each Talmid to develop individually. He didn't want to imprint upon them his imprint, because he felt freedom of choice as the Tzalem Elokim. And this was the Rav's Hashkafa, for which Jewish observer criticized him. It goes against the black world. Our Talmidim didn't dress the same. We didn't have a uniform. The Rav didn't wear a uniform. You've heard me speak about this more than once, and this is not a comment at all. It could be you need a uniform today. It could be you have to be Hasidim today. But the Rav lived a different lifestyle. And in 1975, the Rav got up, and this was not his usual practice. It was what I would call in simple English an aberrant, what would be the word I'm looking for? Aberrant, is that the word? The behavior. It was an aberration. But is there a word? Aberrant behavior. Oh, so I had the right word. It was aberrant in that he didn't, I never remember the Rav doing this before or afterwards. And he got up and he said, and it was a very famous talk which began, Kolo Kola Kitzim, it's Rabbinic Aphorism, that I have no choice. All the thistles, all the thorns are gone. I can't take it anymore. And I have to come out and make a statement against Rabbi Rachman. And it says, and I'm quoting the Rav now, I was told to me that Rabbi Rachman said, and the Rav came out with this tremendous statement that there's no such thing as Havkat Kedushin. Rabbi Rachman doesn't know what he's talking about. That he said, what do you think? Rabbi Rachman is smarter than the Chatam Sofer and the Nol Debi Yehuda, and it absolutely cannot be in the cases under discussion 5, 10, 15, 20 years after marriage, there is no concept of Havkat Kedushin. And then the Rav went into the Chazaka, and the Rav said, and what Rabbi Rachman said, of Tavla Meitav Tuma and Meitav Amala, the Rav said, and I quote, as long as the sun and moons and stars come out, the sun by day, the moon and stars by night, it will not change the fact that a woman is lonely when left alone, unlike a man, and that a woman desperately wants to marry more than a man. Gentlemen, please, I know all your questions, relax, I'm not talking about it, this is not the topic for today. Okay, now I can tell you, between the lines, just listen to me. Little Lonnie Rothkopf, when he heard the tape, I went to Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein.
Statistically speaking, in terms of life expectancy,
right,
a married man decreases his life expectancy by 5 years.
Right.
A married woman decreases her life expectancy by 5 years. In fact, in the history of what's healthy for a woman and what's healthy for a man, it is healthy for a man to be married. It is healthy for a woman to be single.
Okay. With all that you've said, let me continue. Jet, don't get carried away by statistics. Moshe, what's troubling you? I got Dr. Shochet here, and between Shochet and Jackson, Andrew Jackson is shooting me, and Dr. Shochet is slaughtering me. Yes, Moshe. Oh, no, it's very simple. That question I have to answer. It's very simple. Yeah. Oh, no, say that. I don't want to get involved in Rabbi Rachman because I've lectured for hours on it. It's not for now. Dig up the ancient tapes and you'll find it. To answer your two questions. One, what it means if Tavla Meitav Tandu, you see, what Reb Moshe says, Mekach Tari, takes two tremendous problems. A problem of mental derangement and a problem of impotency. What about if you come up with another problem for the sake of argument? A man can't make a living, he can't hold a job. So if you take Rabbi Rachman and extend it, Bizman Hazel, a woman doesn't want to be married to a man that can't make a living. And if I would have known that he's such a shlemas, I would have never married him. You follow me? So if you take that, if you throw out the Tavla Meitav Tandu, you have a much broader area to say Mekachot. That's what Rabbi Rachman is saying. Got me now? That if you take the Tavla Meitav Tandu, and it doesn't exist, you have a much broader area to say Mekachot. Now, second question. Havkot, you're asking me, what's the difference between Havkot Kedushin and Reb Moshe's Mekach Ta'ut, right?
Why
one is good? It's very simple. Havkot Kedushin means you're retroactively annulling a marriage that was. That halachically, 5, 10, 15, 20 years after the marriage, the only time we find Chazal able to do that is where there was a get. I wrote a whole article on this in Eitan Holzer's Hamavaseh. And you don't have to be a great lamdan to know this. Anyone who knows the basic sugyas, for instance, take the most famous sugya, Bitul Haget Shalobefnei Yishah, the Gemara in Gittin, Daflamet Gimel, right? You mavatl the get not in front of the women, and we say, you did something Shloka Hagen, so we'll do to you Shloka Hagen, be mafki kadushin l'mafreya. In a case like that, you have a get. The problem is, he was mavatl to get. There's a psulim to get. There are banu machshir to get. So in order to do afkat kedushin retroactively, all the Gemaras deal with where there was a get. The Gemara in Tuvot, Almanat, I don't want to go into detail, but there was a get. When there's a get, you can say afkat kedushin. Without a get, it doesn't go off the floor. But Reb Moshe's mekechtach means there was never kedushin to begin with. The whole kedushin was betar. It's not that you're mafkil or mafrei is something that was. It means that you had known that the guy was impotent, you would have never married him. You marry a man with the thought in mind you're getting married to have sexual relations. It Ribbono Shel Olam, that's the heart of marriage. So you're getting married, and it means if you would have known, there's no marriage to begin with. It's different. Right, Rabbi Rachman, right. No, right. And right. That's exactly it. So Rabbi Rachman uses Mekach Toch much wider than Rabbi Moshe because of the... The Rav said that the Tav Lemait of Tandu will apply as long as man walks the face of the earth. That, right, therefore it's much more limited. Wait, let me explain. So I went to Rabbi Lichtenstein and I asked Aaron, I said, look, you take a chazakah, the most famous chazakah of all, Ein Adam Oseh Bilato Bilatznut, that a man does not treat his sexual relations as a mere fornication. A chazakah like that, which is elementary, axiomatic, and affects so much of halacha, we know Bizman Hazer, we threw that chazakah out. We say that Bizman Hazer on the west side, a man does treat his sexual relations as a mere fornication. If we wouldn't say that, you understand the problems we would have? Sarah goes out with a guy named Avraham on the west side. On the third date, Avraham says, either you go to mikvah, I don't want to see you again. So Nebuch, she's over 30, she goes to mikvah, they live together, they have relations for 6 months, and then Avraham gets tired of her. There's no commitment, go fly a kite. Begapo yetze, begapo yavo. The way you came in is the way you go out. He throws her out, and then he meets Rivka. Goes out on 3 dates with Rivka and says to Rivka, Rivka, you want to continue the relationship? All right. And now he sleeps with Rivka 6 months. Finally, he's 42 years of age and had a heart attack. He marries Leah to have a child. Hey, wait a minute. That Leah has slept around with two other men, just like Rivka and just like Sarah. You understand what I'm saying? She's an Eshetish. If you say, she slept with a Jewish man the first time. She needs a get. She never got a get. She's an adulteress. The kid is a mamsa. It's from her second adulterous relationship. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if we would say that, you know how many kids with me, mamzerim? You know how many yeshivat in Israel? You guys are going to teach him of Aseret. You're going to teach in Beit Shemesh. You're going to teach in Akotel. You're going to teach in BMT. You're going to teach in Ashraka. 2/3 of the kids you're teaching are mamzerim. Rebbeinu Shalom, are you with me? Where are you? See what's going on? So there we say, Reb Moshe, it all goes back to Rishonim, the Rambam, it goes back to the Goinim. Come on. So Rebbeinu Shalom, there you say, if we were Paskin, God have mercy, the whole Baal Tshuva movement, what are you going to do with all these kids, the Baal Tshuva? You understand? You understand? It's a serious problem. So we don't Paskin that way. We say the Chazakah has changed. I asked Rebbeinu Lichtenstein, why did Rebbe get so furious at Rabbi Rachman? So Aaron answered me, you're absolutely right, but I think Rebbe holds here, it's a gezeirat hakatov. Rebbe holds here, it's ontological. He holds ulebaleich tshukateich v'chudim shalbach, that this is part of the curse on the personage of the woman, that a woman needs a man. Now, I don't want to go any further. I'll only tell you the following. You can debate the issue from today to tomorrow. I can only tell you, you can't ask 19-year-old, I'm going to go into Midrash with Maria and say to them, girls, a boy has just proposed to you, has 3 legs. You know, but you have a proposal, you've gone out with 50 guys already, no one, and you know, this girl already, do you grab the, already has 3 legs. He has it, but he's a boy, he wears pants. So of course, 19-year-old girls will say, never. On the other hand, ask a 35-year-old girl, You may very well get a different answer. I can only tell you the following. It's debatable. I'm not going to debate with you now, Moshe. I'm just going to tell you a story. No, because Moshe, you lack one thing, Moshe. You don't know Shas before you. That's your problem. Because even in Shas already, the Gemara in Tuvah, Ein Adam Da Im Nachash BeKfifa Achat. As much as a woman wants to be married, if the guy beats the hell out of her and brutalizes her, and the guy is insane, he walks around naked, or the guy is impotent, there's a gvul. But we're talking Moshe. If we could decide what's what, he wouldn't have so many shalit and shuvat. Well, that's all of Yiddishkeit. And if you why do you ask me what's what? Or what about hilchot shechita? You don't have machlokes to shach the taz? This is what makes a posek into a posek. Gentlemen, listen to me carefully. No, please, I'm not getting involved in this topic now. Engle davasof. Let me just finish what I want, then you'll ask. So, I just want to explain to you. You can question, it's ontological, a woman, what does a woman really feel? And a woman, I've seen women, the most, I don't want to mention names, the most learned, elegant women with PhDs, they married guys who were halfwits. But they got married in their 30s, and he was a man, a nice man, he made a living, he was decent, he loved her, he brought her children. But a goyim he wasn't. I'll only tell you one thing. I don't know who's right, who's wrong, and I felt for Rabbi Rachman on that level. After all, chazakas do change, all right, but this is ontological, the Rav is my Rebbe. I'll tell you one thing. My wife had two aunts. My wife's family is in America on both sides a very long time, well over 100 years. One part, and both families are either from or assimilated. There's nothing left in between. And she had two aunts who never married. They were American already. They grew up in America. They were born in America. And they were liberated and they slept around, you understand? They're part of a different generation. At one time they denied their Jewishness. They even went so far that they changed their first names, Ad Kedei Kach. Their mother gave them, you know, the mother was one step out of the Belze ghetto. They came from Belze Hasidim. Their brother had payas when he was a little kid, but they were American. They were born, raised, bred in America. They were American like apple pie and totally rebellious, who needs marriage. They were avant-garde. Long before it was popular, they were part of the big sexual revolution of the 1960s into the 70s, 30 years earlier, 40 years earlier. And the years went by. One is dead, one is still alive. And we get a letter from this aunt, my wife's aunt, and she's now, this woman today is in her 80s, but then she might have just turned 70, and she writes to my wife, the biggest mistake she ever made was not marrying, being arrogant, being independent. She says now she looks back at life and she has nothing. Not a husband, not children, not memories, just her own selfish existence, which as you grow older starts to disappear before your eyes. And when we opened the letter, my wife and I both said the same thing. The Rav was right. The Rav was right. We both exactly responded the same way. Okay. Now, what's important about this talk? Yes, Jonathan. I
every year you're playing it.
Let's talk. Right. I have the clearest copy of that tape in existence. It took me many years. This, my original copy wasn't clear. I have an absolute perfect clear copy. It's an overwhelming. That was the Rav. That was Rebbe.
So the Rav said, "Did you tell me that this does the Rav sound like a like does it sound like a modern rabbi? Or does it sound like a Rosh Hashiva?"
Believe me, Rabbi Avraham Spiegel is 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000% right. Anyone who studied with the Rav was a Rosh Yeshiva. I told you that a million times. No, he had more. But the basic gestalt, the basic rav, what are you talking about? You hear it here in class. Where did I get it from? Look at the Baron Lichtenstein. Look at his Talmidim. Eida, that review I gave you of David Hartman, the guy who wrote that is an Eida person. So he writes Hartman's book, the Rav's philosophy. Yes, the Rav had philosophy. The Rav was a gaon adir in philosophy. But the basic gestalt, there's not even a havi amina. But all right, this man is that. I have to play a tape for you. Why? The Rav used the word gestalt day in and day out. The word he used, whether he was a follower, I don't know. But anyway, back here. Now, in this talk, the Rav developed a theme that I spoke about yesterday, I've spoken about that I might pour my heart out, that we in the modern Orthodox world don't know how to surrender. And the Rav told the famous story that we've mentioned in the class many times, but here I tell it in context. And this story reverberated. And this story comes back to haunt us time and again. The most tragic problem, and I just alluded to it a few minutes ago, it comes up in my life year after year after year. The most tragic problem we have, Bizman Hazeh, is the problem of all the divorce. And that reflects in the remarriage. And now you take Kohanim who are looking to marry, and they're in their 30s. Half the girls they're going to date are divorcees. Okay? It's a real problem. The problem is slightly compounded, particularly in the United States, not so much in Israel, that out in the big world, today you even have Orthodox Jews marrying converts. They get attracted to a Gentile woman. Judaism today is very attractive. I don't have to tell you, in contradistinction to other religions, nothing comes anywhere near the level of Judaism. So there are people that are willing to be makabel ol malchut shemayim, although they were not born Jews. And you have cases. I know cases where the convert is more than the original spouse, and leads the spouse to a higher level. But what do you do when it's a kohen to a giyorah? And this is tragic. And the halacha remains halacha. See, what makes it worse is that the kohen has no compensation today for being a kohen. At one time, you can say a kohen was a kohen. He worked in the base mikdash. He got all the animals. He got all the food. He got all the truma. He lived well. Today, what does the kohen get? He gets the first aliyah, and he in a kohen mevarech rishon. On the other hand, he has to give a birchat kohanim. All right, he has to work a little, particularly in Israel. He has to work every day. Baruch Hashem. By the way, I miss that terribly when I'm in Chutz Laaretz. You don't. I understand the Sfatim Duchen. That's what they tell me, that the Sfatim Duchen every day. But where I daven, it's Ashkenazim in Young Israel of Hillcrest. You don't see any Sfatim Duchen in every day. So what does the kohen have today? He has the prohibitions. He can't go to a funeral. Show me a kohen who's going to go into the rabbinate. I'm sure in YU they tell you that a kohen going into the rabbinate, you don't stand a chance. How are you going to? When are you going to be maspid the dead? Of course, Rabbi Riskin can do miracles. He's the only rabbi I know who's a kohen. Never went into a chapel. They would bring a microphone outside the chapel and pipe in his hespit from the outside. But unless you're Rabbi Steve Riskin, it's very difficult. Yes, Moshe. And not connected. But that's a different problem. How do you hold a funeral in a shul? You understand? How do you bring a dead body into a shul? What's it? Only an adam gadol? All right. You can build a shul al tanai. It's difficult. Okay. The problem's the problem. Rabbi Brander, Rabbi Riskin, these are the exceptions. But I know congregations that if they know you're a Kohen, they say, Rabbi, it's not for us. Our rabbi we need mainly in the cemeteries, mainly in the funeral parlors. What good will it do if you're kind? So you have a Kohen. He has all the liabilities with none of the privileges. So the Rav told the following story, of course. A case in Rochester. The boy is in graduate school. He meets this Gentile girl. The boy knows very little about his religion. And this girl had already become a convert, already sought out Torah. She had nothing to do with marriage. It was mamish, a conversion, l'shem shemayim. If I remember the story correctly, And I don't know if I don't believe the Rav told it on the tape, but I believe I heard the story afterwards that in high school it seems this girl was assigned a paper about comparative religion, and from that paper she got interested in Torah and she becomes a convert, and she meets this Jewish guy in graduate school and she brings him to Yiddishkeit. And then the guy goes to the cemetery to visit the graves of his forebears. And at his grandfather's graves, he sees a funny symbol. He thinks it's some lodge symbol. You understand, the Masons, who knows what. And he takes a picture of it. And he goes to his rabbi, and his rabbi tells him that symbol means that your grandfather, your father's father, was a Kohen. And if the father's father was a Kohen, then of course you're a Kohen. How can he marry the convert? And the question came to the Rav, and the Rav said, what could I do? I had to tell them to break up. She walked away. She started all over. Yonatan will tell you, I'm quoting the tape verbatim. She walked away, and she had to start all over. She had to give up the very boy. It's a paradox. She brought him to Yiddishkeit, and because of Yiddishkeit, she had to give him up. And she did it. And this, the Rav talks about surrender. He says, this is what halacha is all about. It has its own orbit. It has its own pattern of responding to challenge, its own principles. But there is a point at which you have to surrender. Now, that's where the Rav turns to Reb Chaim. And here he talks about Reb Chaim, and I'll just add on one little addendum to this in my conversation with the Rav afterwards, but he talks about Reb Chaim. And he says, everyone knows that Reb Chaim was a great Mekhil. And everyone knows that Reb Chaim would get questions from all over Europe. What's interesting, he wasn't a great posek, but when they had questions, they knew in certain areas he was Mekhil, they came to Reb Chaim. But he says, as great a Mekhil as Reb Chaim was, when he reached the boundary and he knew this is the halacha, there's no way you can go beyond it, you have to surrender to the will of the Almighty. And that's exactly what I learned from Reb Chaim, that's exactly what halacha demands of us, and that's exactly the story with the Rochester case. And this is what I told you, and I can put it into context. I was walking with Rebbe in 1978 in Boston, and we were talking about Reb Chaim being Mekhil in Treifat, that Reb Chaim had tremendous kulot right down the line in Treifat. And I said to Rebbe, how come that Reb Chaim got away with it, that the Masham Shvadrin, the Brijina Rav, Shadot Tzavit Masham, was also a great Mekhil in Treifat? He was a Galician posek, a Hasidic posek, a Gaon Adir, the grandfather of the Yerushalayim Magid, who maybe some of you heard him in the 1980s, he was still alive, functioning. Named after him, Reb Shalom Mordechai Shvadrin, and they put the Masham into Cherem. You understand? He had enemies, bitter enemies. They called him a Kaldat. And Reb Chaim got away with it. And the Rav said, the difference was that the Masham Shvadrin published this Kulat, but my Zayda didn't publish. He kept them to himself. It remained in Brisk. Now, it was an interesting answer, but the Rav, Halacha Lamaisa, came down very stridently on Rabbi Rachman and absolutely built the concept of a fence that is axiomatic to Torah, axiomatic to us today. It's a concept we have to stress to children. They have to understand halacha is not just peirot and milk and honey and chocolate and peirot haaretz and tu bishvat. But halacha is surrender. At times it's bitter, it's distressing. We don't understand it. Our mentality doesn't tolerate it. It goes against Western civilization, Western culture, Western mind. But that's the halacha, the Vah Hashem Zu halacha. And that's what makes the Torah true. Now, finally, what I added here was something I knew that Rebbe Paskind, and I had a source for it, and I added it at the end. And here we come, the whole question of women saying Kaddish, also a reflection of the American scene. And here too, it comes back to what I said yesterday. The women today want to express themselves. The women today, they're intelligent, they're learned. Death is a terrible experience. There's no one we love more than our mothers and fathers. No one that mothers and fathers love more than their children. I don't have to tell you what it means to lose a parent. And it's a terrible feeling. This is the ultimate indignity of the human being. If you know the Rav's Torah and the difference between a ninot and a velet, you understand what I'm saying. It's the ultimate indignity of the human being, that human being who is so powerful and so thoughtful and so knowledgeable and has such a good mind, loses a parent or loses a child. And I don't have a spouse. So we have ways of giving vent to this emotion, and this is what the halacha is all about in mourning. And of course, Kaddish is part of it. Whether Kaddish is a dindi or raita, whether Kaddish has any halachic importance, I'll leave to you to research. But on a practical level, Kaddish becomes extremely important, both from the point of view of solace and comfort, sociologically, emotionally, etc. And what about a woman that wants to say Kaddish? And here I come to what I said yesterday. You cannot take the attitude that the woman is a kaldat. Chas v'chalila, you cannot take the attitude her intentions are impure. She wants to say Kaddish. She lost a father. There are no brothers saying Kaddish. It's a family of only daughters. It's a woman who feels she has to express her reverence for her parents, her love for her parents. She wants to say Kaddish. She wants the feeling that she brings solace to herself and to her father's memory. She brings comfort to her father's soul, that the Kaddish Baruch Hu sees he left a woman saying that can say Kaddish. And this is a shaila that's come up, particularly in modern times. What's important here is that the Rav said Eidet Nemana, that in Vilna, at the Gaon's Kloyes, the Rav remembers women saying Kaddish. And this is a quite important testimony. The Rav remembers in Vilna, and you have to know, the Rav spent time in Vilna. When did the Rav spend time in Vilna? Number one, once he reached Warsaw and travel was a bit freer, it seems he visited Vilna. He went because the Rav speaks in terms that he spoke in learning with the great Talmidim of Reb Chaim, of Volozhin. Remember we spoke about the Baruch Berlevowitz, where we spoke about Reb Shimon Shkop, we spoke about Reb Chaim Isaac Rizhinsky, which means that the Rav visited all these places. In addition, when the Rav marries Tanya, he goes back to Vilna and lives there for a circumscribed period of time. I don't want to play games with you like Chaim. I have to tell you, the introduction, Tigrot HaGrid, as great as the volume is, I cannot believe that Chaim Soloveitchik signed his name to falsehood in the introduction just to curry favor with the Haredi world. It's not in keeping with Chaim's personality, but the truth is the truth. Soloveitchik is spelled Soloveitchik, so this Haredim should see that he spells his father's last name the way Reb Chaim spelled it, although the Rav changed the spelling the day he arrived in America. I'm stationed out of the 1930s, where it's spelled already in an Americanized, Hebraized version, not the Yiddish version. And Reb Chaim plays down the Rav's being in Berlin and makes you think he was in Berlin just a few years. Then he went back to Vilna, lived in Vilna a long time, went back to Berlin to get his degree, to go on the boat, to go to the United States. It's not so. He went to Vilna to get married and spent a few months there before and after the marriage. But there's no question that the Rav was in the Kloyes in Vilna, and that he heard women saying Kaddish. No one objected. They asked Rebbe, what about if the woman is the only one saying Kaddish? Let's say, you know, I call, when I see a minion, sometimes this year, see a minion, 500 people, no one is saying Kaddish. That's a real minion. In America, you go to a daily minion, if there are 50 people davening, 38 are saying Kaddish. But in Israel, you can have 500 people in the shtiblach mob scenes, and no one is saying Kaddish. They're davening because they're davening, not because they're saying Kaddish. I call that a real minion. What do you do if a woman's the only voice? And you see, this gets involved with Kol Isha. But I have to tell you frankly, the Rav Paskin doesn't see that there's any problem. I have to agree with Rebbe 1000, not that he needs my agreement, but I mean, I understand. He's right. Why should there be a problem? That's not Kol Isha. Kol Isha, let's assume Kol Isha means singing. I'm giving a definition that's the most elementary definition. I'm not certain the Rav would agree with my definition. The Rav felt, if I'm to interpret what I heard from David Miller and Aaron Lichtenstein about the Rav's viewpoint in Kol Isha, what I heard from Dean Zaren in Kol Isha, so the Rav felt it was a sexual singing, a sultry singing, a singing that was there. What do you want to say? A siren, fine. A Hollywood siren. That much English I know. Baruch Hashem. I know it from Hollywood, not from Homer. A siren. Homer, you're right, Homer too. But I know it from Hollywood. A siren. So the Rav may have held that that was Kalisha. Could be. Because there is Eidut that the Rav and Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner attended operas in Berlin. And Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner attended operas in Berlin. These are facts. Rabbi Kuttner had actually a subscription to the opera in Berlin. Whether Rebbe had one, I don't know. But the Shimon Deutsch, the Rabbi Deutsch, who did the research in Lubavitcher Rebbe in Berlin, he swears to me that he uncovered Rabbi Kuttner's subscription to the opera in Berlin. So no, it's not. Rabbi Deutsch, his research is very good. If you've seen the books, you can't say he made it up. He knows what he's doing. But anyway, with the Rav, I can tell you that Mr. Dean Zar, you understand what I'm talking about? Dean Shmuel Leib Zar, the Dean of the Yeshiva. I don't know, he took a liking to me. At an early age, he would tell me secrets, you understand? And he was a very interesting person. He was a Lithuanian, he was a Telza, came to America. His son, who just died, was the doctor of the Yeshiva. The Yeshiva, I don't know if you have today, an official doctor. Then Dr. Zar's son was the doctor for the Yeshiva. His daughter was Dean of Students at Stern College, Esther Zuroff, Mrs. Esther Zuroff, Dean Zuroff. She's a wonderful woman. She lives in Yerushalayim, not far from her. Her husband was principal of BTA, and Alan Dershowitz became a shagitz because of him. You better learn, if you're a mechanic, what's going to go wrong if you tell a kid off. You understand? Never tell a student off. If you got to tell him off in a nice way, with a joke. Give him a pinch and a clap at the same time, but with a schmeichel. You understand what I'm saying? But he told Alan Dershowitz off, he said, you got a big mouth. You'll make a conservative rabbi. And Dershowitz wrote a whole book to take revenge from his teacher. Chutzpah. See what he does to him in chutzpah. You understand? A chutzpah of a chutzpah, what that chutzpahnik did to that foolish rebbe. But so Dean Zar, once said Dean Zar had a mother living in South Africa. Where is Sean Green? Darn it, the one day I talk about South Africa. Who are the guys? I know where he is. He's out with greener pastures. And no, he's a fabulous boy, Lavi. God should help him. A refuah shleimah, they should invent the cure. Okay, so Jonathan tells this to Sean Green. Who went to South Africa? The Lithuanians. You're aware of that. So he had a mother. His mother lived in South Africa. So every 2 years he would save up money and make the trip. Gentlemen, I'm telling you secrets that I don't think there's a few in the world still know what I'm telling you now. And Jonathan, I sign on the dotted line every syllable truth. So every 2 years he would save up money and visit his mother in South Africa. It was a tremendous trip by boat. We're talking 1920s. 1 year, early 30s, Reb Moshe says to Dean Zar, you're going to South Africa, I'm going to do me a favor. You're going to land in Germany, go via Berlin before you continue the trip or coming back from South Africa and visit my son in Berlin and give me a live report how he is, what he looks like, what he's doing. You got to remember this before airplane travel, the Reb Moshe's in America and Dean Zar. You can probably date the year. It probably has to be about 1931. Because Rav Moshe came to the yeshiva in 1930 till he became friendly with Dean Zar. 32 already, the Rav is leaving for America. And had to be 31. Maybe he wanted Dean Zar to meet the Rebbetzin to be, the Rav's wife to be, you understand? Bring me back a live report. My son, my life, my future. You know what? You read Shulamit Meisselman's memoir, what the Rav was to his father. His father's whole life, like Yaakov and Yosef, they lived their lives through each other. So he visited with the Rav. And Dean Zar told, you know, he met the Rav, he saw the Rav in Berlin, all right? And Dean Zar said to me, and you know, he wanted that Dean Zar had to boast a little. I was a kid, you know, he has to come down on me. He says, and he owes me an opera! He owes me an opera! He's screaming at me, Dean Zar, he owes me an opera! Tell your Rebbe he owes me an opera! I said, Dean Zar, Dr. Zar, what did you mean? And he said, the Rav told him in Berlin, I'm going to take you to the Berlin Opera. That was why you went, you understand, to Berlin. Like you go to Moscow, what do you go see there? The Bolshoi, you understand? I saw the Bolshoi in Moscow. I enjoyed it like a dead horse. But you understand, you have to have a field, mentans, be go. But you got to do a tourist thing. The KGB should see you're a tourist, you understand? The Bolshoi, all right, music, dancing, whatnot. I'm as much involved in that like a Chinaman. But the opera, the Berlin Opera, and the Rav promised him, and he never took him. The tickets didn't show, the Rav didn't have time. By the time he was ready to go, the Tzar was on the boat, returning to the great United States. But what do you see from that? That the Rav went top in Berlin. Din Zah didn't tell stories. I mean, the whole story was not to tell me that he went there. Didn't go. The whole story was that he owed him an opera. And then it was not Rav Yitzchak Kutner. So David Miller once asked the Rav, and you'll ask David for the details. You don't need me to tell you because David's a living, you know, asked him. But assuming, not a siren, but assuming it means singing, but it doesn't mean recitation. I know people in the world today come down with Kalisha, they have Kalisha every day. Ribbono shel Olam, a woman reciting Kaddish is not a shayla of Kalisha. And the Rav said he can't see a difference. Now, if you say that there are 50 people saying Kaddish, and the woman is saying Kaddish with 50 people, so of course, today call Lomishtai, that's like the Heter. If Moshe gives a Heter for a girls' choir, younger girls to sing, you go to a yeshiva dinner and the Echveis of Beit Yaakov, and do the men have to walk out? So if it's a whole group singing, today call Lomishtai. But if it's the woman alone saying Kaddish, that was the Havimini of the Shaila. But the Rav said that recitation is not Kalisha, and the Rav was Matir. Now, what's fascinating is my footnote. My footnote here, I'd say Chanan, this is the volume. Are you familiar with Old Yosef Yisrael B'ni Chai? Rabban Soloveitchik, there was a great tragedy in his family. Why the tragedies in life, what we go through, only the Eibishter can explain, but Tzadik Be'emunato Yichya, we have to go further. I won't allow a tragedy to take away my faith. You understand what I'm saying? What we've gone through, the Holocaust and everything subsequent, and what Rabban Soloveitchik went through. His eldest son, Rabban has six children, his eldest son, Rab Moshe Soloveitchik, was married to a Faskowitz. Her father was a Rav, I believe, in the Chicago area. Prominent Rav. And they have, I believe they have six children together, something like that. And one of the... Do you know the story? I don't want to waste time if you know the story. You don't even know the story. You don't even know how this old Yosef... Old Yosef Yisrael B'ni Chai, you don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, so let me explain it for future generations should know what this book is about. Unfortunately, I was at the funeral. I was an eyewitness. I suffered. I prayed. And that prayers didn't help. So one of their sons... And you have to understand, the grandfather loves a grandchild even more than his own child. There are reasons why. Because your own children, you're busy, you take for granted. The kedako shalaretz, you're going to have children. But that your children should grow up and be decent and have children, you have to be very thankful. So the love we feel for our grandchildren is unbelievable. Though a grandchild does not necessarily... The Rev once discussed this in Sanhedrin. That a grandchild, he said, the love Reb Chaim felt for me was overwhelming, but I couldn't feel that same love. In other words, I felt awe. A grandchild has a little awe. It's a grandfather, a generation gap. Okay, but nevertheless, a grandfather loves a grandchild very much. So this grandson took ill with cancer. And Reb Aaron, you know, to bury a child is the worst curse in the world. The world is built, the human being is built, that a child can bury a parent, and we can survive it. Very few parents can survive burying a child, lo aleinu. And in this case, it was very sad, because the New York Times wrote this up. You don't remember? It was the New York Times headline. The Soloveitchiks have great faith in doctors. And they refused to give up. And it was a question of a type of surgery that there was one chance in a million it would save the child. And the mother was not in favor. She said, let the child die in peace. And Reb Moshe, Reb Aaron said, no, we got to do what we can. And they went to court. Again, this is the problem. Who owns the child? The doctors couldn't go here, go there. The Soloveitchiks went to court to try to force the mother that the court should give a tzav, how would you say that in English, a ruling, a judgment, a show cause. What would be the exact word I'm looking for? A tzav. In Hebrew it would be a tzav. What would be the a tzav? How would you say that in English? A court order. Fine. A court order. So I was right the first time, that the court should give an order to operate on the child. And the judge, the New York Times wrote it up, the judge broke down and cried. And he said, I would need the wisdom of Solomon to give a decision. And he said, I can't give a decision. I have to respect the mother's feelings. I cannot order the surgery. And the child died a few days later, a week later. Funeral was here in Yerushalayim. And Rav Aharon, the only way a brisker could find solace, he published a little volume on Hilchot Avelot, that's O Yosef Yisrael Beni Chai. It was edited, put together by his most devoted Talmud, Yad HaSkut, that you heard him at the Shloshim. He's a great credit to his Rebbe, Rabbi, doctor, real doctor, medical doctor, doctor who can heal, physician. Thank you. When I got my doctorate, my eldest daughter said, ooh, can you make people well? I said, no, I'm not that type of doctor. I can heal books, but I can't heal human beings. But Dr. Applebaum was a great expert in emergency medicine. He saved many a life that I know of, actually. And he's a great Talmud Chacham. He's the Talmud Mufak of Rav Aharon Soloveitchik. Like I revere the Rav, he reveres Rav Aharon Soloveitchik. He put the volume together. And in that volume, among other things, Rav Aharon gets involved in a woman saying Kaddish. And there he says, you know, halachically, what can be wrong with it? But then he doesn't have the living tradition of the Rav. When the Rav says he heard in Vilna, in the Gaon's Kolayz, a woman saying Kaddish, you don't need any more than that. Ribbono Shel Olam. Oh, 1 second, Moshe. Rav Aharon doesn't have that tradition. But Rav Aharon gives another reason, which is fascinating. He says very simply, and if we don't permit a woman to say Kaddish Bizman Hazeh, she'll go to a conservative temple. So to avoid her going to a conservative temple, better to let her say Kaddish. That opens up the Pandora's box. How much do we have to be concerned in our outlook, in our psakim, in our, pardon me, Daniel, our gestalt, hashkafik-wise, our Weltanschauung? How much do we have to be concerned with the concept? And if we do not allow it, she or he will go to a conservative temple. It's a very fascinating question. And I would say, broadly, generally speaking, I don't have to be concerned with that. I have to paskin what I have to paskin. I have to be honest. I have to be loyal. I cannot cross the parameter. I cannot cross the fence. On the other hand, in an issue like this, where halakhically it's permissible, but you'll have people who will say, oh, I don't want women saying Kaddish. My grandmother didn't say Kaddish. I don't like this concept. It's innovative. It reminds me of a place Rabbi Riskin and modernity and YU. You know, so in a case like that, I would say to the person, look, and if she doesn't say Kaddish in our shul, she'll go to the temple and bring her family there. Isn't it better she should say Kaddish? There's no transgression of halacha. So that's what Rav Aharon says. It's interesting. But to me, what's more important than Rav Aharon is when the Rav says, I saw in my youth in the Vilna Kloyz that a woman said Kaddish. And he, by the way, he describes that there was no Ezrat Nashim there, you understand? In the Shtiblach and Katamon, there's no place for a woman to daven by day, you understand? Who ever heard of women coming into daven? There was no place in a Kloyz. Generally in Shtiblach, who needs women there? They don't want women there. It's a men's club. So he says the woman came in and stood in back just to say Kaddish. And no one said, and no one objected. They let the woman say Kaddish standing in back at the end of davening. And I would say, halacha l'maisa, it's important. If a woman feels she wants to say Kaddish, you have to respect the person's feelings. In my opinion, let her say Kaddish. It's not halachically wrong. You have the Rav, you have Rav Aharon, you have Edut Nemana and Vilna. And if she feels that, again, you have to respect the individual. Other women don't want to say Kaddish. Other women don't want to go to shul. A woman wants to come to shul. I notice when I come in the morning, there's always a woman or two davening every morning. In Michlala, there used to be a Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, the great genius. You don't know Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. There are two Mordechai Breuers, the historian and the Chevron Yeshiva Bacha. This is the Chevron Yeshiva Bacha who gets an honorary doctorate from Hebrew University on his work on the Aram Tzova, on the edited edition of Tanakh. He's a genius of geniuses. But he was very opinionated. And he would walk into the Michlala and see the girls davening the hallway, shuckling. He would be furious. My mother didn't daven like that. And who saw women daven? And who said women have to shuckle? And it would so disturb him. He was a character who would yell and shout at the girls. And Rebbe Shalom, I see women davening. True, my mother didn't daven. I don't know if my grandmother davened. I never knew. I had a very pious grandmother, mitzvah my father, but she died when I was 2 years old. I don't know whether she did daven. But Ribbono shel Olam, in the year 2003, that Baruch Hashem, we've survived the Holocaust, we've survived our enemies, we have women davening twice a day, some women even three times a day. Ashrei ayin ra'at hazot. Respect the feelings of the individual. Don't play God. Only God can be Bochein Levavot. And I think Rebbe's approach here is extremely helpful and gives us a lot of guidance on the American scene. If it's halachically forbidden, chas v'chalila. But if it can bring nachat ruach to the woman, and remember, those of you that learned zvachim, nachat, know what I'm talking about, didn't Chazal say a woman should be somach on the carbon because of nachat ruach? They give her a good feeling, make her think she doesn't have to. But if it gives her nachat ruach, alacha kama vakama, to say kaddish for a father when there are no sons involved. By the way, I have no sons, but I don't worry about it. I have enough talmidim. It will be okay. Talmidim, I have over 11,000, but you know, you need talmidim who will remember the Rebbe. I had an experience a year ago in North Miami Beach, an absolutely true story. I see a young man walks in. This is a shul, North Miami Beach. The youngest guy there must be 81. It's about, and the poor rabbi, you know what shul I'm talking about? I'm talking about the young Israel of North Miami Beach, Rabbi Levine. And the poor rabbi once described the situation that every balabuster is a former president of his shul, so he has 100 presidents who hate his guts. Each one, and I see when the rabbi walks in, they whisper to each other, he's 5 minutes late, he's 6 minutes late. And I'm davening there, you know, I was staying in a hotel, by car it's 5 minutes, to walk it's 20 minutes, it's the closest shul. I have a hotel where I can stay, chinam in Kesavash. I only need time because the owners are my devotees, Baruch Hashem. But I need time to stay there. I don't have time to enjoy life. Baruch Hashem, I'm not complaining. So I'm davening, and I see a young man walks in, must be in his 40s, late 40s, and he's asking advice how to get around. And I say, oh, I can help you a little bit. I know Miami a little bit. And I say to him, oh, where do you live? He lives in Whitmere. Where did you study? Why you? And I'm looking at him. And he said, did you ever study? He says, yeah, I studied in Israel. Where did you study? And the guy says, oh, I studied in a school, BMT. And I say, how was it? And he says, I only had one teacher that was worthwhile. I said, who, what was his name? He said, oh, how are you? You know, I said, there's someone named Rabbi Rakefet. And I look at him and I say, tell me, look in my eyes. And the guy faints, said, you know, he had seen me last 25, it's Hershkowitz, Rabbi Meir Hershkowitz's son. Yesterday, a girl comes over to me after class, the new term, and she says, Rebbe, I want to introduce myself to you. I just switched from Shopman's. I was unhappy there, and I was told that I would be happy and most happy in your class. I think my father was your student. He went to BMT. What's his name? Hershkowitz. Tell me, was your father in North Miami Beach last winter? She said, oh, yeah, he was. That's right. He was in North Miami Beach. That's correct. I said, well, you tell your father that I send regards and see if he remembers that the Rebbe made him faint a year ago. Moshe, what's up? No. Reb Moshe Shaket asked a sad question. The end result was they buried the child, they sat shiva, and their marriage was destroyed. Now, I don't say that, I don't go into details because I don't know it intimately, but I was told that this was the Makkah B'Patish. There were problems there before. It seems she's a liberated woman, she's a lawyer, she worked. There were problems there before. And Reb Moshe very happily remarried. He remarried a convert at Sadeket, a woman who had converted to Judaism and a frum woman. And Rav Moshe today took over his father's hashgachat, He's in charge of the Hashgacha. Listen, Rabbaran, you got to give all the credit in the world. Six children, and all six children are Rabbanim. The four boys are Rabbanim, and all in the Rabbanit or Chinuch, and the two girls are Rabbitsons. So you have to give all the credit in the world to Rabban Soloveitchik. I know a few Gedolim in the United States who raised such six lovely children like Rabban Soloveitchik. No one comes close. Not the Rav, not Rav Aaron Cutler, not Rav Moshe Feinstein. You can give many names. No one comes close to the family that Rabban Soloveitchik raised. And I listen, the credit doesn't go to him. The credit goes to Rebbetzin Ella Shurin. She gets all the credit. She was a fabulous wife, a fabulous supporter.